Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on June 20th, 2019, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon's topic is the recent Supreme Court decision in Gamble v. United States. My name is Michael Wallen, and I'm the Assistant Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Clark Neely, who is Vice President for Criminal Justice at the Cato Institute. After our speaker gives his opening remarks, we will then go to audience Q&A. Thank you for sharing with us today. Clark, the floor is yours.
Well, thanks for having me on to discuss what is arguably one of the most important and historically venerated protections in for criminal defendants, and that is the protection against being prosecuted twice for the same offense. And it doesn't take any real reflection to understand why this would be so important, because, of course, when the government prosecutes a defendant, it's because the government is convinced that the defendant has committed a crime. But we have a constitutionally prescribed mechanism for adjudicating those charges that leaves it to the decision of, at least a theoretically neutral decision maker in a jury, specifically is what the Constitution provides will be the decision maker in criminal cases. And that makes a lot of sense, right? Because you have a government that is already convinced of the individual's guilt, but that charge needs to be adjudicated by somebody without a dog in the fight. Now, if we didn't have the double jeopardy provision, you can envision a situation where the government gets to keep coming at the same defendant over and over again if they are unsatisfied with the initial verdict. Person gets tried, acquitted, government remains convinced that the person is guilty, so they get a second bite of the apple, and they get to try the case differently because of the things that they learned the first time during the unsuccessful prosecution. And just allowing the government to continue prosecuting somebody over and over and over again until they are able to obtain a conviction would be intolerable. And so that's the essence of the double jeopardy provision in the Fifth Amendment. The question presented in the Gamble case is whether that provision applies to successive prosecutions by the state, which is who went first in this case, and then the federal government. In other words, if the state and the federal government want to prosecute somebody for the exact same conduct, can they do it successively? And that was the question that was presented in Gamble versus United States that came down earlier this week. The crime at issue, the underlying crime, is one of the most pedestrian and banal crimes you can imagine and frequently prosecuted in this country, and it is the possession of a firearm by a felon. Mr. Gamble was pulled over during a traffic stop in Alabama. He was found to possess drugs, I believe also a digital scale, and a handgun. And so the state prosecuted him for being a felon in possession, which is a violation of Alabama state law. He pled guilty to that charge and received 12 months prison sentence. For reasons that are not apparent from the briefing or the opinion, the federal government then decided to prosecute Mr. Gamble for the exact same crime under federal law, because there is a parallel federal law, Section 922G, that makes it a federal crime to be a felon in possession of a handgun or a firearm. Sorry. Mr. Gamble made a constitutional objection or a defense and entered a conditional plea of guilty. So what he said was, I don't think it is constitutional for you, federal government, to prosecute me for a crime for which I've already been convicted by the state, but I will issue a conditional or enter a conditional plea of guilty, provided I can pursue this constitutional argument on double jeopardy grounds in the courts. So that was the posture of the case. The 11th Circuit affirmed. The district court accepted the conditional plea and sentenced Mr. Gamble to 46 months in prison. So 4 years as opposed to the 1 year that he got from the state to run concurrently with the state sentence. So an extra 3 years in prison after the federal conviction. The 11th Circuit affirmed, as it was bound to do because of the existing Supreme Court precedent permits this, but the Supreme Court granted cert to take a fresh look at the so-called dual sovereigns or separate sovereigns doctrine that has been part of our constitutional jurisprudence for more than 70 years that holds that, in fact, there can be successive prosecutions for the exact same conduct by the state and federal government. It can go state first, or it can go the federal government first, so you can go state then federal, like in this case, or you can go federal then state. And you can even do it after an acquittal. So if Mr. Gamble had been acquitted after a jury trial in Alabama state court, according to the separate sovereigns doctrine, still would have been constitutionally permissible for the federal government to then try him for the exact same crime, not in the exact same statute book, of course, because it was a state crime in the state proceeding, but now it's a federal crime in the federal proceeding, and see if they can get a conviction in the second prosecution. So that's the question presented to the Supreme Court. Should the court revisit and overturn the dual sovereigns exception to the Fifth Amendment? And in a 7-2 ruling with an interesting concurrence by Justice Thomas on the issue of precedent or on the subject of precedent, the Supreme Court affirmed the dual sovereigns doctrine and affirmed the conviction. And so the opportunity to take a fresh look at the dual sovereigns doctrine and eliminate it, it was rejected. And so that it seems very unlikely that the dual sovereigns doctrine will be eliminated from our constitutional jurisprudence. And so I think this important protection, or what was meant to be an important protection for criminal defendants in our system to prevent the government from taking multiple bites of the apple, has, like so many other provisions of the Bill of Rights, been effectively neutered by this decision. And as you can probably tell, it's not one that I agree with. And I think it's no accident that the dual sovereigns exception to the Double Jeopardy Clause has been the subject of sustained and almost uniform criticism in other circles besides the Supreme Court, both in lower courts and in legal academia. But we're stuck with it. So the question, I suppose, at this point is, does the decision seem to be to rest on sound analytical and jurisprudential grounds, or was it more of a stretch? And in my judgment, it was more of a stretch. And I think Justice Gorsuch and Justice Ginsburg, in their separate dissents, have the better of the argument. And I would close by adding that I think it is almost certainly no accident that neither in the government's briefing nor in Justice Alito's majority opinion is there any significant discussion of the historical purpose of the double jeopardy protection in the Fifth Amendment and the effect or the impact of this decision and this doctrine on that constitutional protection, because I think it is this result is flatly contrary to the whole purpose and kind of animating reason for having a double jeopardy protection in the first place. And this pretty well gets it. And I think it's unfortunate. So I'll close with that and looking forward to an interesting and hopefully lively discussion.
Thank you, Clark. We'll now go to our first question.
Hey, Clark, this is Greg Brower. Well done with the summary. That was great. Interesting issue, to say the least. The question that I wanted to get your thoughts on has to do with the kind of the last point you made regarding the purpose of the Double Jeopardy Clause. And that is that I think the traditional purpose, it seems to me, as a lawyer and as a former prosecutor, is that the government, meaning the same government, because, of course, when we're talking about the state and the federal governments, from a two different governments, two sovereigns, as the majority makes clear. But the purpose is that the government cannot retry someone for the same crime after he or she's been acquitted. That, I think, is the core of the double jeopardy protection. And, of course, that is not what this case is about. But even if it was an acquittal in state court, as you know, the law, the Constitution, would allow the second sovereign to try the defendant, even if there had been an acquittal. I think that's always kind of been my impression of the core purpose of the Double Jeopardy Clause. I'm interested in your thoughts.
Yeah, thanks so much, Greg. I appreciate the kind words. Yeah, I think I would agree that at its most fundamental, the purpose of the double jeopardy protection is to prevent what you described, and that is to allow the government to get a second bite at the apple after you've already been acquitted in an initial proceeding. But I don't think that's the only purpose of the double jeopardy protection, and I think that like so many other constitutional provisions, it has multiple purposes. And I do think one of them is to protect people from the exposure to essentially kind of just being hounded almost indefinitely for a particular incident, a particular bit of conduct. And so the idea that just because Mr. Gamble was not acquitted in state proceeding, that sort of resolves any double jeopardy concerns. I think it certainly resolves a double jeopardy concern, which is that you don't want someone who's been acquitted being subjected to another prosecution. But of course, that could have happened. That is part and parcel of the Supreme Court's dual sovereigns doctrine, is that in fact, had he been acquitted in state court, he could have been prosecuted again. It just didn't happen to have happened in this case. But what happened in this case is is still concerning, I think, because as practitioners understand very well, so much of the federal system, the penalties under federal law can be extraordinarily draconian, and they typically are much more draconian than the punishment in the states for the same conduct. And so if you are an individual who has allegedly engaged in certain conduct, you know, that constitutes both a state and a federal crime, I think you've got to be thinking really hard right now what it means to plead guilty in a state court proceeding. It doesn't mean that you are safe from a subsequent federal prosecution where you might be looking at far more time. I mean, in this case, he's looking at four times the sentence that he received at the state level. I still think that's a really serious concern, even if it's not quite at the same level as the concern that we have for someone who has been acquitted and then faces a subsequent prosecution from a separate sovereign. So the concern you raise, I do think, is even more fundamental and a graver concern in some ways, but I don't think that it is the only concern that may have animated the double jeopardy protection.
And in the meantime, Clark, I'd like to ask, going back to the original founding, original constitution, obviously the federal government at the time was not expected to have a police power and was intended for that to be reserved to the states. How does that factor into the analysis here when you have this federal law which almost 100% overlaps exactly with this state law? Do you think that factors into this analysis at all, or should it?
I think it should. Justice Alito didn't, and the point that you just made, which I may elaborate on in just a moment, it didn't really factor into his opinion either. He does mention it, but it doesn't get more than a paragraph. But I do think it's something that people of a federalist society mindset should be very focused on, and here's the really fundamental point. The framers of our Constitution consciously, deliberately, and very carefully denied the federal government a general police power of the kind that the states have. They actually did articulate several federal crimes or several things that could be federal crimes, including piracy on the high seas and counterfeiting. And one can, I think, fairly assume from their decision to specifically highlight or identify a handful of federal crimes a clear intent not to not commit to the federal government a general police power. And I think that's fairly unexceptionable among members of the federal society. So at the founding, you had a federal government that had neither the authority nor the inclination to criminalize, you know, sort of significant amount of conduct. There are only a handful of federal crimes at the founding. Of course, in the modern era, it couldn't be more different. And as a number of amicus briefs and even a couple of justices noted, there are actually very few state criminal laws for which there is not some federal analog. So if you commit a state offense, there's a very good chance that it will also be a federal offense. And I just don't think there's the slightest doubt how the founding generation would have looked at that. They would have, I think they would have had two huge concerns. One is that the federal government is exercising a general police power to criminalize conduct that they specifically withheld from it. And of course, it's doing that in the basically with the strength of some rather dubious Supreme Court decisions and a dubious Supreme Court doctrine, you know, under the Commerce Clause. But then I think their second concern would be that, as Justice Gorsuch points out in his dissent, an interpretation of the Fifth Amendment that places so much emphasis on the word offense. So the Fifth Amendment says that no person shall be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb for the same offense. Justice Alito reads the term offense in a rather lawyerly and technical way to refer only to a crime as defined by a particular sovereign, not as, you know, an act or a transgression. And Justice Gorsuch takes issue with that, and I think, you know, in a way that's quite powerful, and says that he doubts that the framers would have understood the term same offense to bear such a lawyerly and sovereign-specific meaning. And I think that's almost certainly right. He points out that constitutional provisions tend to be written, you know, in more kind of sweeping and momentous terms, not sort of statutory and specific. And so I think it's quite doubtful that the founding era would have, or members of the founding era would have understood the term offense to apply and, or to have such a literal and technical meaning. And they would have essentially said, look, the word offense in this provision essentially means an alleged violation of law. And in this case, the alleged violation of law was being a felon in possession of a firearm. Whether that's a crime at the state level, the federal level, or both, the government, doesn't matter which level of government, you only get one shot at the guy for that. But, you know, how do we know? I mean, that's that we're attributing perspective to people we can't interview and can't meet. But I do think that's a more plausible, I think it's a more plausible way of imagining that they would have seen the current situation. I think they would have been extremely troubled by the idea of a situation where the federal government has the power to go after people for virtually any crime of which they have been tried, whether they're acquitted or convicted by the states, and where essentially basically everybody is now facing the possibility of two prosecutions for the same conduct, which accurately describes the current state of affairs. I think they would have found that to be extremely concerning and perhaps even intolerable.
We now have several questions lined up, so without further ado, we'll move on to the next question.
Hey, Clark, this is Shelton Vaughn. I really appreciate your making this presentation. This is something I haven't followed, and I haven't read the case, but it's very interesting. And you mentioned the dissents. I'm curious what the Gorsuch dissent focused on. I know you just talked about the interpretation of the word offense, but if you could describe the Gorsuch and Ginsburg dissents, I think that would be helpful and interesting.
Yes, I think Justice Gorsuch has the longer dissent, and the thrust of it is that the majority's interpretation of offense as being sovereign-specific, so that they attribute to the framers essentially an intent to use the word offense in a way that only applies or that applies very technically to a crime that has been articulated by a particular sovereign, is a dubious reading of that word in the scheme of things and would need to be supported by fairly extraordinary evidence. And then Justice Gorsuch demonstrates that the evidence in support of that reading is far from extraordinary. In fact, it cuts very sharply the other way. And if you actually go back and look at both the what seems to have been the English practice and sort of founding era treatises, there's a consensus. I understand there to be a consensus, and Justice Gorsuch says there was one, that they were very aware of the possibility of successive prosecutions by separate sovereigns and that they rejected them. There was even a case in England where a person was accused of committing a murder of an English citizen was accused of committing a murder of another English citizen in Portugal or possibly Spain. The reports differ, but probably Portugal was acquitted of that and then subsequently prosecuted in England, and courts found that prosecution could not go forward. There's actually a common law defense called autrefois acquit, which is either French or Latin for you've already been acquitted. So Justice Gorsuch places significant weight on these historical sources. His reading of the treatises is different than Justice Alito's. His reading of the contemporary treatises is that they also reflect an understanding at the founding era that subsequent prosecutions by separate sovereigns were improper. Not surprisingly, I find Justice Gorsuch's treatment of the secondary sources and the relevant historical, or I should say English precedents, more convincing than Justice Alito's. But I think the best that one could say is that they're, you know, in equipoise. And I think, frankly, that's charitable. But let's say that the secondary sources are in equipoise, then it kind of comes down to a question of who you think sort of bears the weight of persuasion. And I think that the weight of persuasion is on or should be on whoever is advocating for an interpretation of the relevant language that would significantly deprive it of much of its effect and create a situation, as I alluded to earlier, where virtually, I don't know if I could say virtually every, but let's say the vast majority of defendants, of state court criminal defendants, are now exposed to the possibility of a subsequent federal prosecution, whether they are convicted or acquitted in the initial state proceeding. It seems to me extraordinarily unlikely that the framers would have felt comfortable with that scenario, and on the contrary, it seems quite likely that they would have found that scenario to be extraordinarily troubling. And so I think Justice Gorsuch, and of course I, would then say, well, then the sort of burden of demonstrating that the dual sovereigns exception to the double jeopardy clause, that the burden of demonstrating that it is the better reading of the relevant language lies with those who would embrace the dual sovereigns exception. Justice Alito, I think, neatly kind of sidesteps that argument by saying, well, but it's precedent. And so, you know, we're not writing on a blank slate here. So maybe if we were, we'd have more work to do, but we're looking at least 70 years of Supreme Court precedent here. And so in fact, no, the burden is on you, you know, who would suggest overruling or advocate for overruling this precedent. You have to make, you know, a sufficiently powerful case for overruling precedent. And I think we should get into maybe momentarily what may be going on behind the scenes here, because I do think that the question of what to do about precedent and whether the court should lightly overrule precedent or not lightly overrule precedent is probably very, very significant. A lot of it's going on in the background, except in Justice Thomas's concurrence, which is all about precedent. But I do think there is something, there may well be something going on beneath the surface here, where a lot of what the justices are doing, a lot of the argument they're having back and forth, is more about precedent than about the merits of this case. And I would say, just quickly on Justice Ginsburg's dissent, I think it's largely, not overlapping, but largely based on the same rationale as Justice Gorsuch's, and I think she finds unconvincing or unpersuasive, as do I and as did Justice Gorsuch, the proposition that the framers clearly meant for the term offense in the Fifth Amendment to have the rather technical and sovereign-specific meaning that the majority attributes to it. And then, of course, there's also the fact that the Double Jeopardy Clause was not incorporated at the time that the Supreme Court first kind of invented the dual sovereigns doctrine. And that has potential relevance that I won't delve into, but that's another point that the majority was, I won't say they gave a short shrift, but found on, by which they were unmoved. Let's put it that way. I'll end with that.
All right. We'll now move to the next question.
This is Don Santarelli. Good work, Clark. One ideally likes the rationale of a Supreme Court opinion to fairly compel the result. In Alito's analysis, it doesn't have the sort of compelling rationale. It just deference to precedent. Alito tends to, over the years, be supportive of the executive function and less libertarian in questioning power, authority, etc. Can you read anything into his opinion that seems derivative of that, or is precedent his fig leaf?
Well, thank you for that question. I certainly wouldn't try to, get inside the head of a sitting Supreme Court justice to say, whether I thought an argument was a fig leaf or not, or at least I wouldn't do it lightly, and I wouldn't do it in this context. I do think that Justice Alito does tend to sympathize with, or maybe not sympathize is not the right word, but tends to credit arguments in favor of the exercise of federal power in the criminal space. I think that does seem to be a pretty consistent mindset, and of course that's not surprising given his background as a career federal prosecutor. I do think that there's a very interesting aspect to this case that didn't receive as much attention as I think perhaps it should, and that is that one of the federal government's arguments in its briefing was that one reason not to be too concerned about about this door that is opened up by the dual sovereigns exception, and particularly in an environment where so much of the federal criminal code duplicates state criminal code, so that you really do face this very real possibility of being prosecuted back to back, first by the state and then by the federal government, is that there's this doctrine called the Petit Doctrine that is embodied in the U.S. Attorney's Manual, and it provides that subsequent prosecutions like the kind that happened in Gamble are disfavored and should only be undertaken when there is some really powerful and compelling federal interest, and that even then an assistant attorney general has to sign off on it. So we don't really need to worry. These things are going to be rare and unlikely and just not going to happen very much, because they only happen when there's a really compelling federal interest at stake. But then you look at the facts of this case and you see, look, this is a garden variety felon in possession case where the guy got convicted at the state level. And if this case qualifies for subsequent federal prosecution, can you possibly think of a case that wouldn't? And so this – go ahead.
Right. I'm concurring in your analysis.
Yeah, so it really kind of, to me, rings hollow that they would say, don't worry about eroding this constitutional protection, because you can trust us to be very reasonable in exercising, this power that we will now wield, continue to wield. And I just, the facts of this very case seem to completely undercut that assurance. And, that's putting aside the fact that we shouldn't have to depend on the discretion of individual prosecutors or even the Department of Justice itself to enjoy protections that are explicitly or even plausibly articulated in the text of the Constitution. But that seems to be, that's where the government ends up in this case, is we should just sort of basically rely on their discretion. And, let me add one more thing, and that is that, Justice Alito makes the point in his majority opinion that, and the government made this point in its briefing, that it's been fairly rare that we have seen subsequent federal prosecutions of this kind, to which my response in part is, yeah, because it's so rare that we ever see an acquittal. I mean, the vast majority of people who are indicted in this country, whether in the federal system or in the state system, end up pleading guilty. The rate of acquittals in federal system is, I can't remember what it is, but I think it's something like 0.4% of people who get indicted end up ultimately acquitted. And so we wouldn't expect to see this very often. Because why? Because prosecutors in this day and age almost never lose a case. And there's just not, much, there's not much call for a separate sovereign to be able to come in and essentially backstop an acquittal. And maybe, who knows what happened in this case. It's mystifying why a federal prosecutor felt that with everything that's going on in the world, they should take time out of their, you know, sort of busy schedules and just basically stick it to this guy for an extra 3 years in federal prison. Maybe there's a story there that we don't know, but it didn't come through in the briefing, and it certainly doesn't come through in any of the opinions. And so it leaves one kind of mystified why the federal government felt that it had to use this, I think, you know, exceptional and or hopefully exceptional and rather extraordinary power in such a garden variety or such a seemingly garden variety and pedestrian case.
But I think your answer to my question was answered by your speculation as to the politics of precedent.
Could be. Could be.
That's how I look at it. Thank you so much.
You bet.
We'll now go to our next question.
Yeah, I wondered, since this is a matter of constitutional interpretation, whether you think that there's a statutory fix that Congress could enact and what that might look like.
Yeah, that's a great question. And the answer, I think, is yes, because there's no, obviously, there's no constitutional obligation for the federal government to exercise this power that the Supreme Court has left intact. I think I'd have to sort of think through what the wording would be, but we certainly have some guidance because there's a significant number of states, I forget what the count is, but it's more than a dozen, I mean, it may be as many as 20 or 25, that have at least some protection against subsequent prosecutions, even when the Constitution has been interpreted to permit them. And so there certainly is already some existing statutory language at the state level that we could look at to essentially figure out what's the right way to word this. And I think, you know, that would be a very salutary response on the part of Congress. But of course, this is the exact same Congress that has effectively chosen to wield a constitutionally forbidden general police power, right? So I guess the question is, are they really being kept up at night by the fact that not only should, well, I mean, just take a look at the crime in question here. This is a felon in possession. It is not obvious where the federal government gets the authority to criminalize that conduct. And you actually have to go and look at the text of 922G, and then you won't be surprised to see that there's the standard reference to anybody who possesses a firearm in commerce or affecting commerce, right? So you know what the hook is going to be. But if you've got a Congress that is wielding constitutionally dubious power to effectively arrogate to itself a general police power, is it likely that that same Congress is then going to come along and say, oh, but you know what, let's go ahead and make sure we amend the federal code to make sure people don't are not exposed to successive prosecutions? I'd like to hope so, and I think they should, but I'm skeptical whether they will.
One quick follow-up. That DOJ exercise of discretion rule that you talked about, is that called the Pettit rule, you said?
It is P-E-T-I-T-E. I don't know how to pronounce it because I've never heard anybody say it, but it, you know, that would normally be pronounced Petit. So it's I call it the Petit policy. It's said to be reflected in the U.S. Attorney's Manual, but there was there's no representation in this case that, in fact, they got sign-off from an assistant AG, and there's no explanation anywhere that I could see in any of the briefing about why this was supposedly an extraordinary case justifying the resort to this subsequent prosecution power. It just seems like they just decided to, you know, that a year in state prison was insufficient, so this guy's going to get four in federal.
We don't have any more questions lined up at the moment.
And Mike, I think I do think we might want to talk about precedent a bit in this case and what's going on with it.
All right, absolutely. While we're waiting for some more questions to come in, go ahead and expound on that.
Well, there's a lot of high level speculation in Supreme Court watcher circle these days that precedent has become an extremely fraught issue and that cases calling for the Supreme Court to basically abandon stare decisis and to reverse existing doctrines or cases, that this is a particularly bad time to be asking the court to do that because there's an elephant in the room, and the name of the elephant in the room is Roe v. Wade. There's great concern on the part of our friends, our liberal justices, the ones on the left, that the right to Supreme Court found constitutional right to an abortion may be in jeopardy with the current makeup of the court, and certainly if President Trump gets to name another justice, that the Roe and Casey line of cases could be in some jeopardy, and that a lot of what's going on is signaling between the various kind of factions of justices about how seriously the court ought to take stare decisis, how lightly or casually on the one hand, or reluctantly justices should reject existing precedent. And Justice Thomas has this rather strange concurrence where he goes on at some length about how precedent should not be given as much much weight as it typically is, about how the real question in any case, in any constitutional case, the touchstone of the court's inquiry should be the relevant constitutional text and not just what the court has said about it over the years. But then at the end, he goes through this, you know, this whole explanation of how we shouldn't give so much weight to precedent, and then at the end says, but I'm going to give weight to precedent in this case because for him, the rationales or the arguments in favor of and against the dual sovereigns exception were basically kind of in equipoise, and so he says, so, you know, that's not enough for me to overrule precedent. But anyways, I do think, of course, we cannot know what's going on in any given case, but it does seem that the court is, the members of the court, the justices, seem unusually mindful of and sensitive to issues of precedent and stare decisis. And so to be a litigant in a position asking the court to overturn existing case law or existing doctrine this term seems like a bad place to be. This is not a good term to be asking the court to overturn some case. And if that's what you need them to do in order to rule in your favor, then your chances are probably less good this term. Still not impossible, but less good this term than they might be some other term.
All right. Thank you, Clark. No more questions have lined up, so I believe that is all we have for today. Clark, did you want any other further closing remarks on gambling?
No, I think, well, I will just add one thing. I do think that, and this, you know, this won't surprise anybody because of my current job as being in charge of criminal justice reform at Cato, but I do think that there is reason to be concerned about a system where the prerogatives that, you know, in favor of the government, in favor of prosecutors are such that almost nobody exercises their constitutional right to a jury trial anymore, and any ruling that exerts more pressure or enables prosecutors to exert more pressure on people to abandon the constitutionally prescribed mechanism for adjudicating criminal charges is one that we should be concerned about. And I do think that this decision affirming the dual sovereigns doctrine will enhance the power of prosecutors to exert pressure on people to plead guilty to crimes. And I think we should all be very concerned about that, whether we agree or not that it's a legitimate practice.
All right. Thank you, Clark. And on behalf of the Federalist Society, I'd like to thank our expert for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.